This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll unpack a particle physics mystery. But first, Alzheimer's disease often can take a devastating toll, both on people with the disease and their caregivers, as people with Alzheimer's gradually lose the ability to take care of their own basic daily needs. This backwards progression, first losing higher planning functions, then things like skills with money, eventually moving on to the loss of simpler skills such as dressing and bathing. Well, that has been called retrogenesis. And there are medications that can help slow that decline. But new research finds that providing the right supportive care in addition to these medications can help people with Alzheimer's live fuller, more productive lives, reducing some of those symptoms and stopping the slide backwards. The work was presented earlier this week at an Alzheimer's Association International Conference in London. And joining me now to talk about the work is one of the researchers on that project, Dr. Barry Reisberg. He is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the NYU Langone Health Center here in New York. He was also involved with the trials for the Alzheimer's medication memantin back in 2003. And we should note that a pharmaceutical company that distributes memantin. Am I saying that right?
Memantine is the way I say
Thank
it.
You.
But either is acceptable. That's fine.
They partially funded your study, correct?
Well, Forrest, yeah, it did. That's correct.
And let's talk about what you found. You found that in addition to giving them the medication, if you gave support, what kind of support, you could actually make things work out better.
Right. Well, we call it a CIPCM program, a Comprehensive Individualized Person-Centered Management Program. But the important message is that, as you've already said, Alzheimer's disease persons go backwards in terms of normal development. And so at the stage where the medication was approved, which we call the moderately severe stage, as you said, people go backwards in terms of losing the ability to dress and to bathe and losing more basic functions. So what we realized is that this has a positive side, which is that Alzheimer's persons can still learn, but they need to learn at their developmental level, at their age level. And so our management program is based upon this realization. So at the most basic level, when Alzheimer's persons lost the ability to dress themselves, we help the caregiver to learn how to help the person to put on their clothes
So in other words, you're saying they could relearn that skill.
Exactly, and that goes for everything.
Yeah.
So, and when, of course, and then there are some basic other basic concepts that everyone can understand. So currently, these people, once as they go backwards, as they reach this stage, and this stage is the stage with the greatest amount of disturbances, this is the most burdensome community stage of Alzheimer's disease, they're basically frequently left alone. In other words, the caregivers don't know what to do with the people. But so in a certain sense, we empowered the caregivers. We showed the caregivers that they can help the person. They can help the person to help themselves by learning how to dress again, which makes the person with Alzheimer's right. feel better. And it makes the person with Alzheimer's less disturbed, and this has many ramifications. So, children at six, these are people really from six, five to 2 years of age. Not only can they learn, but they need activities, and they're often left on their own. And the same thing happens to them as would happen to children if you left them alone.
Right.
So they and if you leave them in a group.
So you don't want to leave them alone. You want to give them attention and help, and you're finding.
You want to give them activities.
How much training? How much do you have to train the caregivers to understand what's needed and to
give them part? We had a comprehensive program. Yeah. So we had eight educational sessions lasting three hours each. This was a 28-week program. And also, even beyond, so the educational sessions essentially had the kind of information that I was quickly conveying to you and understanding the course of the disease. And then also we went into the people's homes and we looked at the homes. We saw what the needs were. So for example, they might need a bath bar. Or they might need a platform in order to be more comfortable when they bathe themselves, and we provided them with activities. So we learned about the patients, we learned about their backgrounds. So one of these patients had a musical background and used to play the guitar, and he was able to, for the first time, he was able to. At this stage, and again, we're talking about a stage which is the equivalent of a 4 or 5 year old, but like a 4 or 5 year old, he was able to learn to use the harmonica for the first time. And he would come to my office playing the harmonica. And of course, I would, I was, you know, I thought this was great.
You were surprised even by your own results.
Yeah, I was, I was happy. He was happy. And I encouraged him. And I told him how great it was. And that helps everybody.
Yeah.
And it gives him dignity. This particular person was a clergy person. So he was accustomed to helping people.
Right.
And it was possible to give him back his dignity in that regard.
But you were not able to, just so that we're clear, you were not able to stop the decline. That normally progresses, but you're able to get the maximum out of each stage of that decline is what you were saying.
Well,
or were you able to stop?
There are three things that happen to the Alzheimer's people. They lose thinking abilities, and they lose functional abilities, and then in this stage in particular, they develop behavioral disturbances. So we were not able to help them in terms of thinking abilities. And interestingly, the medication is able to help a little bit with thinking abilities. But we were able to help them functionally. And so functionally, we got an effect which was 750% of the medication on a functional scale, the same scale as was used for the medication. And this is on top of the medication. Everybody got the medication.
Right.
And when people are able to do things and they have activities, then, of course, they become less behaviorally disturbed, just like a child would.
But this would just seem like obvious to people. Is it because these people were just given up, or we give up on Alzheimer's patients?
Well,
we don't think about...
We compared it. So the numbers I'm giving you, we got, in total, globally, 10 times the effect. And those effects were on functioning and behavior, not cognition, but they sit on top of the medication effect. So this was in comparison with usual community care.
Right.
So the other people got all the services that are available in the community, support group meetings.
Let me because we're running out of time. I want it now. How do we empower people to take your study and use what you have learned, and use it in their own facilities?
Well, the first thing is by them again. These are simple principles.
Yes.
But in fact, taking care of a child is simple principles. The same simple principles. But in actuality, it's not necessarily that easy. And the same is true here. Having the proper guidance, especially in this disease where there's a lot of behavioral disturbances and so forth, is very important. So we want to get this message out, and we want to do it in every way we can. And this is one of those ways.
Is there a manual, or is it just simply paying more attention?
We have published this. It's a paper, and it does have pages of principles.
It talks about what you did in your study.
Exactly.
And
what we did in the principles, right. And more or less. Well, it's not a guide step by step. It is the principles of what we did.
And do you have any further studies? Any how you would take this a step further, perhaps?
Well, we did a 28-week study, which was the same as the medication. Mm-hmm. We modeled it on the medication mm-hmm. study. They were exactly the same in terms of their thinking abilities, as it happens, as the medication, exactly the same level. We have an extension that we haven't fully published yet. We published it as an abstract. We presented it once. We extended it for a year. And the people got even better.
Really?
Yeah. So you know, not only do they get better over 7 months, but they get better over a year. And we don't know how long this process could continue, but it makes a huge difference for the people. And, you know, as you say, we need to get this message out, and this is a first step in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And so... We have, you know, we're helping you get that message out because this is a growing problem, right? This is not going away, Alzheimer's and dementia. Could it be similar to other dementias, or is it just Alzheimer's?
Other dementias are in general quite similar to Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah.
These principles should apply for other dementias as well.
Dr. Reisberg, thank you.
Thank you.
For taking time to talk with us today. Dr. Barry Reisberg is professor in the Department of Psychiatry and director of the Zachary and Elizabeth Fisher Alzheimer Disease Education and Resources Program. That's at NYU Langone Health here in New York City. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, a new particle-smashing experiment could challenge what we know about the universe if they can prove this experiment to be true. They can prove it and do it again and convince people. We've got some little head-scratching news to talk about, so stay with us. Support for this podcast comes from Casper. Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers. An in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. It combines supportive memory foam and a springy comfort layer for a sleep surface that got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design keeps you cool at night. I've been sleeping on a Casper, and I really like the way it shapes to your body. Buying the Casper is easy. You select your mattress online, and Casper delivers it free to anywhere in the U.S., Canada, and now the U.K. Considering the fact that we spend one-third of our lives on a mattress, it's very important to truly sleep on a mattress before committing to it. That's why Casper also offers a 100-night risk-free trial, so that if for some reason you are not completely happy with your mattress, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. And right now, Casper is offering Science Friday listeners $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/scifry and using promo code SCIFRY. Terms and conditions apply. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. They are the smallest collisions on Earth, but create some of the biggest mysteries. I'm talking, of course, about collisions between tiny subatomic particles, like the particle smashing they do over at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. As for the mysteries, experiments at the LHC have come up with a pretty puzzling result. The shattered remains left over after a particle collision, well, they just don't quite add up to what the prevailing theories predict. And those strange observations have occurred at a handful of other particle colliders, too, as detailed last month in the journal Nature. And all of this opens the door to some new exciting physics, maybe even new particles, if, that is, these experiments can be replicated, because particle physicists are notoriously picky about their proof when it comes to new discoveries. Joining me to talk about what we know and what we don't know is Pearl Sandick, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah in Salt Lake. She joins us from a theoretical cosmology conference in Stockholm. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Sandick.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, you're welcome. Can you walk us through what this experiment was doing and what have physicists been smashing together and why what's coming out is so weird?
Yeah, so there are actually three experiments. One, as you mentioned, is at the Large Hadron Collider, so it's the LHC-B experiment. The LHC is the largest, the highest energy man-made collider in the world. The other two experiments were actually looking at collisions of electrons and positrons and collision energies that are much lower, so about 1/1000th of the LHC beam energies. So those other experiments are Bell in Japan and Babar in California. But all of them, what they're all looking for is you smash these particles together, you see what comes out at the end of the day, and if there are any particles that are left over, if the data doesn't match the standard expectation, then you might have found some new physics.
Mm-hmm. And so what was weird? What was the expectation that was not matched?
Yeah, okay. So what the experiments we're looking for are whether the standard model lepton, so you've probably heard of the electron, the standard model includes two other charged leptons, so one that's about 200 times heavier than the electron, that's called the muon, and another that's even heavier called the tau. And these three particles, the electron, the muon, and the tau, the only differences between them should really be their masses. So according to the standard model, they should both act the same way under the weak nuclear force. So they should have the same types of interactions. And what they're doing is, in order to determine whether the electrons, muons, and taus feel the weak nuclear force in the same way, they smash these particles together, and then what they're looking for are some particles called B mesons. So these mesons are objects made of a quark and an anti-quark. And if one happens to be created in a collision, it's not going to stick around for very long, but at the end of the day, you'll have a final state that has maybe electrons, muons, or taus in it. And they look at the rates of those different productions of electrons, muons, and taus to see if they match the standard expectation. So what they found is that it turns out that all three of these experiments see more events with taus than you would expect from the standard model alone.
Wow. Does that mean...
Yeah, so...
Are people, you know, wringing their hands now about the standard model? Maybe it's...
Yeah, so that could mean that there's something else besides just the weak force, so something else besides just the standard model. But it's a little bit confusing because it's tough to reconcile these results with other results and find one model that kind of fits everything.
Yeah, that is the problem. It's been the problem for 100 years, hasn't it?
Yeah.
But scientists, as I said, they're very picky, and they're not all believing these results yet, are they? They're not quite convinced.
Yeah, not completely. So these results have a statistical significance. And when you combine all three, so individually they have some deviation from the standard model expectation. When you combine all three, because they all three agree, you actually get a stronger result. But it hasn't quite risen to that gold standard level that we expect in particle physics in order to be able to complain to say that we have a new physics result. So we're still kind of, we're waiting to see, but this is definitely an interesting indication.
Could this mean that there are other particles yet that are causing this that we have not discovered?
Yeah, so there are a couple possible explanations, and they all have to do with new particles, basically. So one of them is that you could have something that's like the weak nuclear force, but that the taus would feel differently than electrons or muons. So there's like a new particle that carries that new force, and we would call it a W prime, in analogy with the W boson that carries the normal weak force. So that's one possibility. A second possibility is that there's actually a new type of Higgs boson. So the Higgs that was discovered at the LHC in 2012 doesn't have any electric charge. But the particle that would be needed to explain these results actually does need to have an electric charge. So there could be a new charged Higgs boson that's maybe heavier, so heavy enough that we haven't seen it yet at the LHC. So that's a possibility. And the third possibility has to do with the fact that these events at all these experiments involve both leptons, so electrons, muons, and taus, and quarks. And so there could be some type of new particle that actually talks to both leptons and quarks, and we would call that a leptoquark. And there are models of leptoquarks that might explain this as well.
Wow, talk about a particle zoo all over again.
Yeah, for sure.
What about dark matter? Could it be showing up here somehow? You know, because we don't know what it is.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so dark matter actually is related to this story, but in a kind of interesting way. So at this point, there's not an obvious connection, but it's certainly possible. And one of the things that might connect to these two anomalous, or this anomalous result with the need for dark matter, is something called supersymmetry. So there are a lot of symmetries in nature, like the laws of physics don't change with time. So we would say that they're symmetric under time translation. And it turns out that if you think about the mathematics that describes the particle physics that we understand, there's only one more, like, really different type of symmetry that you can add to the mathematics of the standard model. And that symmetry is a symmetry between particles with integer spin that we would call bosons and particles with half-integer spin that we would call fermions. So if this symmetry, the supersymmetry, exists, then what that means is that at a minimum there are twice as many particles as there are in the standard model alone. So if you add that many particles, it sounds like you're making things a lot more complicated, but at the end of the day, you actually get out some really nice consequences. So one is that one of those new particles could very likely be the dark matter, and it just happens to work out that you get like roughly the right amount of dark matter left over in the universe. Another interesting consequence is that the Higgs boson that was discovered is actually predicted within these models. But not only that, they predict extra charged Higgs bosons. And so those extra charged Higgses could be the things that are contributing to these anomalies from LHCb, Bell, and Babar. So it could be connected, but we really don't know yet.
I'm just, you know, sitting here with all these superparticles swimming through my head. But back to where I was 40 years ago when I first started covering this, is that we're back to more particles, superparticles, other kinds of particles. You know, there's still no giant theory yet, is there, that will explain everything?
Not necessarily. I mean, we have to wait for the data to tell us what direction to look in, you know. But I think we're getting there, and also these types of experiments that are being done that look for anomalies, not necessarily just new particles, but that look for other indirect signals of new physics are really important.
And when you say new physics, what does that mean to a layperson?
It means any kind of new thing that is different from the standard model or beyond the standard model. So the standard model works really well, but there are some reasons why we know there's something beyond it, right? Mm. So the standard model only includes three of the four fundamental forces, right? Gravity is not included. Dark matter, and no explanation for dark matter is anywhere in the standard model. And so there are reasons why we think there's something else, and we just kind of categorize, I would call all of that new physics.
Do we have the right tools? I mean, do we need a bigger atom smasher, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, we have good tools now. Checking these results is going to be really key to see if this particular anomaly is the thing that's pointing us in the direction of new physics. And so there are a couple things that are needed, actually, to check this thing. One is that we need to make sure that the standard model calculation is actually really correct, because if you have the standard model calculation wrong, then, you know, a deviation from the standard model might not really be a deviation from the standard model. But the other thing is we need more data to see if that the statistical significance does rise to that gold standard level where we're willing to say, yeah, this is a discovery of new physics. So both Babar is done operating, but Bell and LHCb are both upgraded, and they're going to give us a lot more collisions. And so that'll give us the data that we need to be able to determine whether this is a real signal. And actually, it'll give us some more information besides that, too. But that's a good start.
Okay, so we'll have to watch this space, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Sandick. Fascinating.
Yeah, thank you.
Pearl Sandick is Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah in Salt Lake. Next up, take a deep breath. It's not only possible but probable that one of the molecules that you just inhaled was expelled by Julius Caesar when he spoke his final words, "E tu, Brute." Now, I'm not making this stuff up. I know what you're going to say. It's just one breath expelled over 2,000 years ago. How could I be inhaling those same air particles? There's no possible way there should be anything left. But as you'll soon hear, the math that we're talking about does check out. And that's because many of the molecules that make up our air, like nitrogen, are surprisingly hardy. They stick around for hundreds, even thousands of years, which means every breath we take is in some way tied to Caesar or Cleopatra, Alexander the Great, George Washington, Kim Kardashian. The air we breathe ties us to the past, and not just the human past, but Earth's geological history as well. And the story of these gases and our relationships to them is explored in a really good new book, Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us, by science writer Sam Keen. And he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome back.
Hi, science thanks friend. For having me back.
This is a great story. The way you talk about air, I mean, you have a great talent for writing.
Oh, well, thank you.
Let's get the heavy math out of the way first.
All right.
Here. How do we know that every time I inhale a breath of air. I'm actually bringing in Caesar, maybe a molecule or something of Caesar.
Yeah, there's kind of two forces working against each other here. One is how small an individual breath seems compared to the atmosphere. It seems minuscule, very, very tiny percentage. It's something like a 19 zeros with a one after it. Very small. But the other thing is that every time you do take a breath, you inhale something like 25 sextillion molecules, which is a 25 with 21 zeros after it. So that's almost incomprehensibly large. And if you do the math, kind of work through everything, turns out that those two numbers, the really big one and the really small one, almost exactly cancel each other out. And so statistically, it turns out that every time you breathe, there's a very good chance you're inhaling probably about one molecule that Julius Caesar exhaled when he died in 44 BC.
And that would be a molecule then for everybody in the world.
Yeah, everyone in the world.
Who's ever lived.
And there's lots more left over because there's 7 billion of us. There's 25 sextillion molecules, so there's plenty more.
We can share.
Yeah.
Why does the air last that long?
It's mostly the nitrogen in the air. A lot of the components of the air are reactive. They go away after a while. But nitrogen is a very, very hardy molecule. Sticks around for millions, maybe even billions of years. Two atoms of nitrogen with a triple bond between them. Very, very stable, very hardy. So once nitrogen gets in the air, it stays around for a very long time, usually.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Sam Keen about his new book, Caesar's Last Breath. Let's go back to the very beginning, because one of the most fascinating parts of the book, which because I'm a geology geek,
is
where did the air come from?
Yeah, it's a question we don't think about. Yeah. It just seems like it's always there. But
Earth Why is there actually... air was an album of it was reputed a few decades ago.
Yeah. So we've actually had on Earth, depending on how you count, about four distinct atmospheres in its history. There was a very early one. It was just sort of some wispy hydrogen and helium, kind of a comb-over atmosphere that very quickly got blown away. Then there was a second atmosphere that came about from volcanoes that was mostly made up of really nasty gases, ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, the rotten egg smell, a lot of carbon dioxide, very nasty. It wouldn't have supported life. If you'd gone in a time machine, stepped out back then, tried to take a deep breath, it would have just destroyed your lungs. So that was the second atmosphere. And the third atmosphere actually came about from those same volcanoes. What happened was it was just a little tiny bit of nitrogen every time one of those volcanoes erupted. And over time, that nitrogen just built up very slowly over billions of years. But eventually, you get enough nitrogen to kind of fill the atmosphere and be the dominant gas that we have today. And then sort of a latecomer to this is oxygen, which didn't start to accumulate until, you know, maybe a few hundred million years ago. It took a very long time for oxygen to build up to appreciable amounts in the air. And in fact, life on Earth predates oxygen by quite a ways. Oxygen was actually poisonous for most forms of life that existed on Earth through most of its history. And in fact, oxygen probably killed more organisms than any other substance in Earth's history.
So life had to evolve to use the oxygen?
To be able to utilize oxygen, because it's so reactive that it was poisoning most of the early microbes that were around. The way I think about it is sort of like a nuclear power plant where you have plutonium in there. Plutonium's great. It's very useful. A lot of energy there. But you have to keep your eye on the plutonium. You have to keep it confined. You can't let it just kind of roam around and be floating around in a nuclear power plant. Mm-hmm. Same thing with oxygen inside microbes and cells. They have to keep it tightly confined, and they can only use it in certain places.
They used to call it something else besides oxygen, didn't they, early on?
They did. It was called phlogiston when they first invented it. This very great old-fashioned name, phlogiston.
What was it, just a Greek, Rome? What kind of
word? It was an idea back in the late 1700s, maybe a little before that, where they were trying to explain how substances burned. They really didn't have an idea about the fact that there was something like oxygen that might exist. It was really coming out of the idea of burning things. And for a long time, they thought that this phlogiston existed. If you burned wood, burned a candle or something, it would be lighter afterward. The ash would be lighter. And so they thought, oh, okay, when something burns, this sort of mysterious phlogiston goes floating up into the air. And that's how something burns, is it releases right. this phlogiston.
And somebody actually had to discover oxygen, right?
Yeah, there were actually a few different scientists that get credit for discovering it historically. A Swedish man named Carl Scheele, then an Englishman named Joseph Priestley, and then the latecomers who sort of horned in on this was Lavoisier, the very famous French scientist.
Is no one ever really first in anything?
Yeah, no. And unfortunately for them, oxygen turned out to be kind of a cursed discovery in that all of three of them met very, very bad ends.
Wow. Wow. There's a TV series there somewhere.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break and come back to talk lots more about air with Sam Keen, author of Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. You can tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I, with some questions you'd like to comment. We'll talk about it after the break. Don't go away. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Sam Keen, author of Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. And as my engineer, Neil Rausch, said, maybe we should relabel it. Inhale, Caesar. Get it? Get it, Sam? He copyrighted that one, right?
Okay.
Hey, if you like to tweet us, so you can send it to our tweet to at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. We have actually some questions that came in through the internet during the week as we talked about it. Let's go to one question first.
Has the level of oxygen, the concentration of oxygen in our atmosphere changed over the last 50 years or so?
That's kind of from Utah.
So the level of oxygen in the air probably hasn't changed over the last 50 years in any appreciable way. But if you look a little farther back, a few hundred million years, it definitely has kind of veered wildly up and down. And that has some interesting effects for planet Earth. When it's in the low teens or the mid-teens, it's very difficult to get fires going on Earth. So you actually don't see any fires anywhere in the geological record of Earth until a few hundred million years ago when oxygen finally built up to an appreciable level. So no fires back then.
Yeah.
And when it's very high, you see some interesting effects on animals especially because insects, they have sort of this inefficient breathing process. They don't have lungs the same way that a lot of other animals do. And as a result, they struggle to get oxygen to their interior cells. But if oxygen levels are a lot higher, insects can actually get much, much bigger. In the fossil record, you see, you know, millipedes that are a yard long. You see, you know, spiders the size of seagulls. You see these gigantic, gigantic insects just because the level of oxygen in the air was high enough to support them. So it does have some interesting effects.
I have some interesting tweets coming in from Joy, who says, thanks for the good cry. Learning I'm literally breathing the same air as my late father completely blew my mind.
Yes. It does really connect you with everyone in your past, everyone you want to be connected with, yeah.
Brandon writes in and he says, so the Earth's atmosphere doesn't replenish itself very often at all, if ever. Does this help support the CO2 is heating the Earth?
Yeah, there is some recycling. So, you know, nitrogen molecules might get brought in by nitrogen-fixing bacteria. Oxygen we obviously use in our metabolism, daily processes. But a lot of the molecules do stick around for quite a while in the air.
Is the air, did they evolve, did the air and the water on Earth evolve basically at the same time?
Yeah, you see them both coming in very early in the Earth's history.
Are they connected, you know?
Yeah, there is some connections between them. Something like the carbon dioxide, which was a really heavy component of the early atmospheres, sometimes that dissolves in the water, ends up becoming a mineral, something like that. So water can help regulate the levels of certain gases in the air. Or, you know, water vapor, when it goes up in the air, becomes one of the gases in the air. Water vapor is actually one of the big drivers of weather around the world. So there's definitely an intimate connection between things like liquid water and the air.
A lot of early chemistry involved scientists trying to figure out what effects different compounds had on humans. And one of them, which was very important, was what you talk about is nitrous oxide.
Yeah, there's actually little bits of nitrous oxide, little bits of it's laughing gas, basically, in the air all the time. And there was a lot of interest in the air because people back then believed that air caused diseases. So malaria literally means bad air. There was a theory about how diseases got spread. And a couple scientists thought, well, you know, if bad air can cause diseases, maybe good air can cure diseases. So they were doing things like exposing patients to nitrous oxide, making them breathe it to see if they could pure consumption or palsies or other sort of old-fashioned diseases. Mm-hmm. And what they figured out was that, okay, it maybe doesn't work so well to cure these diseases, but there was a scientist named Humphrey Davy who had a lot of friends, people like Samuel Taylor Coleridge, other poets, and they figured out, well, it has some interesting psychological effects here. So while Davy and his boss, a man named Thomas Beddoes, were running this clinic by day to try to help patients expose them to gases, Humphrey Davy and his friends would sort of sneak in at night and just inhale these gases and basically get high and try to, you know, try to figure out what psychological effects they were having.
Well, so, you know, your book has created a tweet storm. I'm talking with Sam Keen, author of Caesar's Last Breath. Oliver wants to know, besides oxygen, do we need any of the other gases in the air to survive? You know, if levels of O2 and CO2 stayed constant, can other gas percentages change? What do we need?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, actually, because we do need the oxygen. Without that, we just would not be able to live. It's a question, though, with some of the other gases, because nitrogen, oxygen makes up 99% of the air, but they contribute zero to global warming. They don't warm us at all. And actually, if it were only nitrogen and oxygen in the air, the average temperature of Earth would be a lot lower, something like 40, 60 degrees lower than it is. So we need those other gases to increase the temperature of Earth to make it a little more comfortable. The problem, though, is that we're increasing it enough where we're sort of swinging past the comfortable level and pushing toward more extreme. So if we didn't have all those other gases there, Earth would be a much colder place.
A small section of your book delves into, how shall I put it, the bodily gases. What got you interested?
The gases we pass, yes.
We pass, gases that we pass, we burp, whatever, you know. What got you interested in that?
There was a man I read about named Joseph Pujol, who was a Frenchman. He was performing in the Moulin Rouge, late 1800s, Paris. And basically, his act was to fart. He would inhale air through his rectum, and he would do impressions of animals. He would sing songs this way. And he was actually the most popular act in the entire Moulin Rouge, the most popular, the most funny, the highest paid. And it sounds a little lowbrow to talk about this, but, you know, he had fans like Renoir, the painter, Ravel, the composer. Freud was a fan. The king of the Belgians once came incognito to see him. So a lot of highbrow, but some lowbrow in there as well.
So you could have easily entitled your book, instead of Caesar's Last Breath, Caesar's Last Fart.
Caesar's Last Fart, yes.
Because we'd been inhaling that also.
Yeah, I mean, it's in some degree, yeah, we have been. It's uncomfortable to think about, but those gases are in the air as well.
All right, again, speaking of smelly gases, we've got another caller wondering about the connection between the smell of substances and breathing them in.
Hi, this is Rebecca from Pleasant Grove, Utah. My question is, I wonder if sometimes when I smell something that's toxic, like when they put chemicals in my grass to fertilize it, can you smell it without breathing it in? Or if you're smelling it, that means you're breathing in something toxic. Or is the smell separate from the substance? Thank you.
You're welcome. Is that beyond your pay grade to answer that?
No. So if you're smelling something, it's getting into your body, obviously, getting into your nose. It might not necessarily get to your lungs, but it's getting into your nose at least. The question is whether the thing that you're smelling is toxic and whether the thing you're smelling is harmful. So maybe you're smelling part of it, but that's not the toxic part. Or there could be toxic things that you can't smell. So it's kind of a complicated question, but if you can smell it, it is getting into your body to at least some degree.
So the air is not mixing all the time, going in and up and up to the different atmospheres, up and down.
Yeah.
Is it doing that
all
the time?
Yeah, it is mixing quite well. So the Caesar thing, you know, after he exhaled his last breath, it first sort of got spread at the same latitude as winds went around Earth, so at that latitude. But eventually it spread out, smeared over the entire atmosphere, probably in about 2 or 3 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm. You also include in the book, I've read a lot about Einstein, but I've never heard this story before, about Einstein invented a new kind of refrigerator.
Yeah, we don't think about him as a home appliances guru, but he also was very interested in gadgets like that. And I talk about it because when you talk about refrigerators, basically gases are what's driving refrigerators. They're sucking the heat out of things, dumping it in another place. And Einstein got interested because the gases that they were using back in the 1920s were usually toxic gases, things like methyl chloride, sulfur dioxide, ammonia. And it wasn't uncommon for the seals to break on refrigerators and the toxic gases to leak out and to suffocate whole families in their apartment. You know, 2-3 children and their parents would die. So Einstein called up a friend of his, Leo Szilard, and said, you know, there has to be a better way. So the two of them sat down, started tinkering, and actually invented 3 different types of refrigerators, which Einstein was very happy about. He thought it was going to make him some money. He was in kind of dire circumstances at the time, living in Germany during a time of hyperinflation. He had just remarried. He had 2 families to support. So he was pretty excited about the prospects for these new types of refrigerators that he and Szilard invented.
Speaking of air in our atmosphere, a couple of questions. Why do we still have air? And let's say Mars doesn't have air.
Yeah, Mars is a little smaller, and for various reasons, Mars doesn't have the gravity to hold on as well. Mars also lacks a magnetic field in the way that Earth did. So Earth has. So Earth, because of that magnetic field, when you see particles streaming in from space, that magnetic field helps deflect those particles, push them away. Whereas Mars, lacking a magnetic field, those particles ram right into it, and they can help push the gases away. So Mars does have a vague atmosphere, but not a strong one like
that. So may have had that same kind of gasification early on, but it just couldn't hold on.
Yeah, exactly. Mars almost certainly did have a similar to our early Earth atmosphere. Mm-hmm.
You also talk about something that is very, very important to the history of industry, and that is our understanding of steam, which is a gas.
Steam is a gas, yeah, the gaseous form of water. And steam was really the big driver of the Industrial Revolution. In fact, there were lots of different gases involved with things like explosives, steel creation relied on gases, but steam was one of the big, big ones. And James Watt is the one usually associated with that. But it was really learning how to harness the power of steam, how to harness the power of this gas and direct it. Because gases are very powerful. They can do a lot of work. But again, you have to confine them, harness them. And Watt and his partners were the one who really figured out how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Even in more modern times, humans have had a very complicated relationship with gases. And I'm thinking about the same person who created nitrogen from the air, who found a way to take the nitrogen to create fertilizer to feed millions, also created the chemical weapons for the Kaiser in World War One.
Yeah, the man involved here is a Fritz Haber. Was a very, very complicated—
The Haber process,
yeah, very, very complicated. So nitrogen, you know, it's very important to us. We have nitrogen in every protein, every DNA strand in our body. And there's a lot of nitrogen in the air. The problem is that nitrogen in the air isn't a useful form. We can't inhale that and our bodies can't use it. You have to turn that nitrogen into something like fertilizer, get it into plants, then we can eat the plants. And Haber was the one who figured out how to take that nitrogen out of the air, make it into a substance, ammonia, that then you could turn into a fertilizer. And it's not much exaggeration to say that's probably the most important chemical process that human beings have ever discovered. Half of the human beings on Earth would not be here today without that process. It is a vitally important process for modern civilization. And Haber was rightly hailed at the time as one of the great benefactors of humankind. Unfortunately for him, he also was an ardent German patriot, and when World War I came around about, you know, half a decade or a decade after this discovery, he turned all his chemical genius over to the idea of making gases that we could use in warfare. And he was really the one who turned gas warfare into the deadly, awful thing that we think of today. So on the one hand, he was a great benefactor of humankind. On the other hand, he did these awful, terrible things, terrorized millions and millions of soldiers during World War I. And you even see right after the war, he won a Nobel Prize for the Haber process – but was also condemned as an international war criminal almost at the same time. So even back then, people had this very contradictory view of him.
Very interesting portrait of him in the series Genius about Albert Einstein. He's a figure in that series.
Yeah, he knew Einstein. Yeah, yeah. In fact, when Einstein was having some trouble with his family, Haber was the one who came and comforted him. They were close in a way.
Yeah. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Sam Keene, author of Caesar's Last Breath, a really, really interesting book. It's a page-turner. I mean, if a science book could be a page-turner. And you start out by just talking about air, but you go into all this interesting chemistry that's involved with oxides, I guess, because oxides are part of air.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun to be able to start with something like the air and then to jump into so many different areas and talk about things like warfare, volcanoes, talk about anesthesia, there's a little bit about aliens in there. There's a lot of different places you can go with the air if you kind of know how to decode and interpret those stories that are sort of flitting invisibly around in front of us all the time.
And, you know, that's an interesting way to teach science. In fact, we have a tweet from David Finney who says, idea like that makes kids think. Create a connection to history. Keep it up. That we are all forged in stars is so powerful.
Yeah, it's a way to get people's attention and to help them remember the science, too. Because when you do science in story form, which is what I'm really trying to do in this book, it's easy to remember that in a way it isn't easy to remember sort of disconnected facts. If there are heroes, villains, conflicts, our brains are very good about remembering and absorbing it when it's presented that way.
Yeah, because people don't actually think about scientists as people.
Yeah, right. They're sort of these abstract robots that are just, you know, they take in coffee and they spew out discoveries. That's what scientists do. But, you know, they are humans. They have the same motivations that all of us do.
You think? Anything coming up? Anything to follow this book? You're working on something new? Or?
We're throwing around some ideas with my editors right now. But right at this point, really focused on the book. I'll be speaking at a lot of different places around the country. So you can go on my website, find out some more information about that.
Which is?
It is samkeen.com. So just SAMKEAN.com.
Well, what made you decide on this topic? Why air?
Because it's such an important topic right now. A lot of controversy about it. A lot of questions about what the future of air will be. So I thought, you know, if we know the past, the history of air, all these rich, rich stories about it, it'll help us understand where air is going in the future, too.
The air is everywhere. Where is that from?
The air is everywhere.
Hair?
I don't know. I think of the water everywhere, not a drop to drink.
Yeah, the air is everywhere. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great book. The book, I'll read the whole title because
it's
a book. Very good. This is Sam Keene, author of Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. And to read an excerpt from the new book, you can head to sciencefriday.com/gases. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and we had engineering help today from Neil Rauch and Brian McCabe. Thanks to all the folks at NPR for help this week. If you'd like to write us, send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can also go to our website at sciencefriday.com. And every day is Science Friday on social communities. We're up tweeting and on Facebook and all.